Friday afternoon Legislative Council Committee meeting. This is the first Legislative Council Committee meeting we have held in quite some time, in part because of scheduling conflicts and challenges that were created during the last legislative biennium as it related to the special sessions. So we are here today to catch ourselves up on quite a bit of work that has gone left undone and to bring us back into compliance with all the things we need to do. So I'm going to allow Legislative Council Chamoff to start to take us through the agenda.
Mr. Chair, members, thanks very much for coming this afternoon. First, an introduction. Our committee assistant is Corinne Rollman. She'll be the one who is herding you through this process when we meet during the interim, making sure that you get your per diem and that sort of thing. So please remember to stay on her good side. She was once a member of our United States Armed Forces as a member of the Intelligence Service, so she's very good at finding you if you don't want to be found, and I don't recommend trying to get away. An overview of what we'll be covering today, we'll be approving the minutes from the past three meetings. We'll be committee will be considering a request from Senator Ringo and 49 other petitioners to have the Office of the Legislative Council assist in the drafting of citizen initiatives. I'm going to go over the committee's duties, focusing on administrative rule reports, then take you through the various reports that we'll be covering. This will be pretty much the committee's steady diet over the coming 2 years. The standard procedure is that we have individual attorneys in our office come up and provide you with a brief overview of a rule that we've determined is problematic. There'll be a written report by that attorney. Also, if we've received a response from the affected agency, if the agency chooses to respond, the agency may come and present the agency's position. Then the committee votes whether to adopt our office's report. We're going to have a discussion of a somewhat unique kind of rule review toward the end of the hearing, where Ms. Vanderbilt will discuss rules that a citizen alleges are either duplicative or in conflict. And I'll provide some more information on that when that time comes. We'll be introducing new employees to the office and also presenting service recognition awards.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we move then to the second order of business. Consideration. First order of business, approving the minutes for the September 6, 2001, March 3, 2002, and March 26, 2002 Legislative Council Committee meetings. Colleagues, I have taken a few minutes before this meeting to review the minutes of these meetings, and I didn't see anything that was inconsistent with my recollection of the events of some time ago.
Need a motion?
Yes. Senator Minnis?
Chair, I move the adoption of or the approval of the minutes from the previous meeting.
Senator Minnis moves the adoption of the minutes from the March 3, 2002, the September 6, 2001, and the March 26, 2002 Legislative Council Committee meetings. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Senator. Greg? Yeah, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 1953, when this body created this office, you also gave us the direction to assist in the preparation of an initiative if 50 citizens brought us their signatures, and this committee decided that there was a reasonable probability that the measure that we'd be helping to draft would actually make it on the ballot. Those of you who are involved in the process last session may recall that we suggested repealing that statute because in the preceding 48 years, the statute had never been used. Thanks now to the diligent efforts of the Senator from Washington County. We've now actually received our first three requests by citizens to have our office assist them with the drafting of initiatives. That's
what?
Those requests, the signatures, and a brief description of the measures are behind the red divider in your notebook. And I guess I would defer to Senator Ringo to provide any additional information about the measures. The issue for the committee is whether to direct the office to work with these citizens to prepare these initiatives, with the determining factor for you being whether you believe there will be a reasonable probability that these measures will gather enough signatures.
Okay, thank you, Council. Senator Ringo, do you want to just comment on the requests?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, we can request legislative council assistance in drafting initiatives after the session is over. We don't have the ability to do that right now unless we use a priority bill request. And there were a number of constituents in my area who are interested in taking some significant steps at restructuring our revenue system. And I think we all know that is a hot topic, and the likelihood of getting things through is something that we can debate for a long time. But I do know that there are a lot of interested school activists and school folks who are looking at measures like this. And so that's what this request is about.
Okay. And why don't you give us a brief rundown, Senator, on each of the three separate requests and what the initiative is about? Because as I read the statute, our determination as to whether or not to direct Legislative Council's office to assist in the drafting is based on the judgment of the committee that there is a reasonable probability that the measure will be submitted to the electors of the state under the laws to the submission of initiative, under the laws relating to the submission of initiative measures. So it'll help us, I think, to understand the subject matter in,
right,
in making the judgment we're required to make by the statute.
And I think that's a very difficult judgment to make, because a lot of signature gathering efforts just don't get together the organization and the financing necessary to do it. So it's hard for me to give guidance on that, but I'm happy to describe what these do. The first one relates to Senate Joint Resolution 18, which is to allow local option funding for school outside of the constraints of Measure 5, Measure 50, and the state school funding formula. The second one would require a certain length of the school year. And the one after that would require, I perhaps I skipped one. Yeah, the last one would require the class size does not exceed the limit set forth in the quality education model. Essentially mandating class size to a certain maximum limit.
Okay.
I guess I'd just also point out that I think one of the questions for the committee is this imposing a significant burden on legislative council? And since all of these are pretty much drafted in bill form already, that it really isn't imposing much of a requirement. It's simply taking what are already existing in one form and asking it to be drafted in another form.
In council, maybe you can elucidate for the committee what you anticipate being required if the committee were to approve the requests.
Mr. Chair, I'd simply I anticipate that someone will make a motion and you'll vote on it one way or the other. After that, we'll just take care of the work and get the measures drafted for the petitioners.
No, that's what I meant. Assuming we approve the request being raised by Senator Ringo and looking at the signatures, which I assume that we are in the right form and we believe they meet the statutory requirement, I guess I'm interested to know what additional work it's going to require of your office if we were to approve it.
Mr. Chair, not a substantial amount. Senator Ringo is correct that at least the first initiative is already substantially complete, and the other two are simple enough that they wouldn't require a great deal in the way of resources. I doubt that it would cause any kind of an impediment to the work that we'd be preparing for the Legislative Assembly at this time.
And thank you, Council. And I've been looking at the list of signatures, and while most of them don't look troubling to me, I do have questions about some of them, like a Tony Corcoran or a Ginny Burdick or a, let's see, who else is on here, a Bill Morissette.
Mr. Chair, it's amazing who will sign a signature list if you just tell them don't read it.
Okay. Are there questions about this discussion on the part of the committee? It looks like Senator Minnis and then Representative Richardson.
Well, I guess I'm wondering if these bills are substantially, if they substantially exist in bill form now, why not just give them copies of the bills and let them go about? What benefit is there in having Legislative Council draft something?
It's a fair question. Senator Ringo, do you have a response for what was the basis for bringing these forward when the language was generally drafted?
I think it's to assist drafting them into the initiative format.
Okay.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Is there a substantial difference in terms of the format as an initiative compared to the bill?
Council?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, no, they're substantially the same. The heading on the top is a little bit different, but the text is virtually identical.
Okay. Could I do this on my own typewriter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, we'd rather you didn't, but I'm sure you're capable of it.
Certainly plenty of other people who put initiatives on the ballot have done it on their typewriter. Representative Richardson.
Chair, my concern is that if this hasn't been done in 50 years and these are going to be the first three that are done, we're setting a precedent of having LC draft initiatives on the size of a classroom and, you know, for school. And I would hope that this kind of precedent would not expand into the utilization of LC on bills that are not previously drafted, that have, where they're going to subjectively have to, or this committee will be making a determination as to whether we think or not think that it's going to get through. And I would hope that there might be some kind of guideline that we would adopt, which would say, you know, broad public policy or some other guidelines so that we don't have LC drafting bills that deal with the size of a classroom.
Yeah, and Representative, I share some of your concerns. Obviously, 173-140 wasn't adopted by us, and what they meant when they said in the judgment of the committee that there is a reasonable probability is a tough call. Obviously, a call that this committee is based on our legal obligation or the statute required at this point to make. And that's the standard. You know, we've had a lot of discussion over time about changing the initiative process, and one of the ones that circulates regularly in this building is that people ought to use, and in fact we even talked about at times requiring people to use the drafting services of Legislative Council simply to avoid some of the drafting error that has occurred over time as initiatives have been brought forward. So I think in my mind this discussion harkens us back to a broader discussion at some point that we're going to have about how the initiative process operates and whether or not it might not make sense to make more available Legislative Council's office for drafting purposes of initiative solely to avoid some of the problems that we've had with the legal challenges and the like. But I think the question that's presented to us today is obviously to meet the obligations as required when presented with the legal request under 173-140, and I think that's what we're going to have to decide. Madam Speaker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious as to the time this will involve for Legislative Council.
Mr. Chair, Madam Speaker, if you give us the green light today, I assume we'll have these done by probably early the week of March 14th.
April.
April. We'd rather have March 14th, but
wiggle room.
Follow up.
Yes.
How much competition would there be with current workload and the way in a Legislative Council?
Mr. Chair, Madam Speaker, My impression of these measures is that they are not going to be substantial drafting projects. Therefore, I don't anticipate that our preparing the initiatives will keep us from being able to do anything that we're currently doing for the Legislative Assembly.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative. Oh, yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question of Senator Ringo. Are you planning, or have you already filed, to use paid petitioners, or is this going to be an all-volunteer effort?
Not, sir.
Mr. Chair, I ask the question because I believe the chance of putting an initiative, because I think from what you read, we have to reasonably believe that we'll make the ballot. And the chances of a petition making a ballot without paid petition gatherers in the past have been very, very slim. So I guess unless I know for a fact that they will be paid using paid petition gatherers, I'd be prepared to vote against this because I don't think they would make the ballot unless they are doing that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Well, just to respond to that, I'm amazed at how angry Portland school parents are and Portland school activists are. They're just looking for something to do. And with a little organization, I think they could pull it off.
Senator?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, most of their former school students have moved into my district. Or into one of your districts in Washington County.
Yeah, they're, no. Some of them are angry too, obviously.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
Again, of the Legislative Council. It says Legislative Council shall cooperate, this is the statute, with the proponents of an initiative measure in its preparation. What does that mean? Does that just mean writing the initiative measure, or does that mean there is additional work that would be required subsequent to the actual writing of it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, we interpret that command to mean that we will prepare the initiative and, if necessary, provide any legal guidance that the petitioners might need to help them make policy decisions about the terms of their initiative.
Would the attorney-client privilege apply?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I would think not.
Right, Mr. Chairman, I think the question still before the committee is the statutory directive that there would be reasonable probability that it would be submitted to the electors of the state. Given Senator Burdick's bill crossing the Senate floor requiring 10% of the signatures to be filed before you get a ballot title, and some of the difficulties relating to how you get these things, I would submit to the committee that there's probably not a reasonable chance to submit it. Because that's the compelling question what a committee is asking.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a difficult legal standard for us to meet, and to know how to really evaluate that. And we're all going to be left to our own best judgment as this request moves forward. It is interesting that it's never been made before, and so we are the first
legislature.
Do you want to address the standard?
No, not the standard, but why it's never been made before.
Okay. Why don't you tell us why it's never been made before?
Mr. Chair, the reason that we haven't received requests under this statute before is that whenever a constituent has wanted us to work on an initiative, the constituent has simply gone to a member and had that member request the use of our services. It hasn't required going to the trouble of getting 50 signatures, but as a practical matter, when we receive those requests during session, we generally don't work on them at the speed with which we might otherwise if it were a request for currently needed legal work.
Okay. Fair enough. Comments?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Przanski.
From what counsel says, if Senator Ringo gave a note to Mother with his constituents to go down to talk to them, am I hearing that they would actually be able to have that request honored without it being a priority for a member, but that the work would probably take a little bit longer than, in this case, a week to be prepared?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, in the past, when a member hasn't wanted to use a priority request but wanted an initiative measure drafted for citizens, we have logged that measure in as an O, say in this case it would be an O5 request,
okay,
and we wouldn't work on it until after the session. If a member wanted the initiative drafted now, during session, after the time that for request has passed, then a member needs to use a priority to provide the note to have us work on the initiative now.
Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there time sensitivity here to get this on the ballot or before?
Well, I guess I made the determination that it was just better to work on things sooner than later. And that I'd rather not wait until I was going to say the summer. We don't know when session's going to end. Pick the most. I thought the letter's dated February because I wanted to get it going.
Well, here's what I'm going to tell you my thoughts as the person currently chairing the committee. We'll take them in order. We'll take them in order of their approach, and we'll vote on each of them independently. Given the nature of my own, and this is everybody's going to be subject to their own view on this issue, I think the first one, the Senate Joint Resolution 18 of the three of them, in my mind has the highest likelihood of actually obtaining the necessary signatures to get on the ballot if we fail to take some action in the legislature on Senate Joint Resolution 18, which allows local option funding outside the Measure 5 and 50 limits. My personal view is the next two, in my mind, based on, and again, this is all subjective, but based on my read and the subject matter of those measures, in my mind, don't, at least in my mind, give me the judgment that they have a reasonable probability that the measure will be submitted to the electorate. And it's based on the subject matter of what those two measures are attempting to do. So I'm telegraphing that to the committee, simply my thoughts on the three of these. I think they are subject matter driven. I could see the first one surviving. I don't necessarily believe that the second or the third one, given sort of the narrowness of the approach, would actually be successful in getting on the ballot. And that's how the committee chairman intends to vote on the motions. Anybody want to comment, or should we just call for the vote?
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Minnis.
Parliamentary inquiry.
Yes.
Do you need an individual separate motion on each of the requests?
I would believe that you do need an individual separate motion for each of the requests.
Can any member of the committee make the motion? Is Senator Ringo obligated to do so since it's his?
No, I think any member can make the motion. Senator Ringo serves on the committee, obviously, but I think, you know, he is any, so he can make the motion as well if he wants to, but I think any member of the committee can make the motion. If there's no motions, then we'll move forward and not proceed. Is anybody going to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move that with regard to the first one, regarding the Senate Joint Resolution 18, that the committee approve Legislative Council's office presenting the initiative as requested.
Senator Ringo has moved that the committee approve a request made pursuant to ORS 173-140, allowing Legislative Council's office to cooperate in the drafting of a proposed initiative identical to that of Senate Joint Resolution 18. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Council, or excuse me, Senator Minnis.
Question to the maker of the motion.
Yes.
But for the purpose of the meeting the statutory requirement, could we have some explanation as to why the maker of the motion believes that there's a substantial or reasonable probability that this is going to be submitted to the electors?
Senator Ringo?
I think it's a fair question. It's hard to know, but as I said earlier, I think there are a lot of people who do not believe that the legislature is going to come to the rescue of our school. And they are looking at the initiative process. They're looking at different vehicles. This is one of the vehicles, and I think there's a good likelihood that they would get behind this and gather the signatures. And that is objective. I can't give you a more objective argument than that.
Chairman,
Senator Minnis.
I have a question.
Yes.
Senator Ringo, are you familiar with a specific group of individuals who intend to follow through and circulate and issue a petition and actually gather the signatures for the purpose of getting this before the electors.
I have had a number of discussions with people who expressed a willingness to do that.
And, Mr. Chairman, another question?
Yes.
Is it your opinion that those individuals are going to follow through and actually attempt to achieve the necessary signatures to get this before the electors?
I think there's lots of uncertainty, but I think it's more likely than not.
Mr. Chairman, based on Senator Ringo's comments, I'll support the motion.
Okay. Further questions? All right. So the motion is to move the first one and allow the Legislative Council's office to assist in the drafting. Seeing no further questions, Corinne, call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Byer? Senator Byer, excuse me?
No.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Representative Krasanski?
Aye.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Speaker Minnis?
Aye.
Co-Chair Carno?
No.
Co-Chair, I have the wrong name in here. Williams?
Aye.
And Co-Chair Brown?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I will not be making a motion on either two.
All right. Anybody else? All right. That order of business is concluded. And frankly, based on how these meetings usually go, that's probably the most exciting thing we're going to do all afternoon. Because now it's administrative rule review. Greg?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually what I'm going to do now is ask you to turn to look behind the green divider where I'm going to discuss first what it is you do as members of this committee. First and foremost, you hire and fire me. You supervise me, making sure that I'm doing my job correctly for certain personnel decisions. If I hire a person as in the same pay classification as an attorney or higher, this committee has to approve that hiring decision. You set policy for the office to follow. For example, our office follows a gift receiving policy that is substantially more restrictive than you will find in other parts of the building. We have substantially less fun as a result of that, but we think it's appropriate. You advise us in setting the procedures that we follow for drafting bills, set our personnel rules, and also provide guidance to us where necessary in the preparation of the Oregon Revised Statutes. I'm going to skip over the administrative rule report and follow up with that. By statute, this committee prepares what I would call fallback explanatory statements for ballot measures. If the explanatory statement committee can't come to a decision on a statement that will be published in the voter's pamphlet, then the Secretary of State uses a statement prepared by this committee. Typically what happens is, as a courtesy to the Secretary of State, we prepare a draft statement in advance of the explanatory committee's meeting, provide that to the committee, then the committee works off of that to provide its own. We will also file statements approved by this committee in the unlikely event that the committee can't reach a decision, but at least during my tenure, the Secretary of State has never had to fall back on a statement prepared by this committee. When the need has seemed to arise, you also have the statutory authority to direct me to appear in court to represent the legislature's interests. If you turn the page, begin our discussion of administrative rule review and rulemaking. Those of you who are, this is more for those of you who are not JD impaired, but This page describes sort of the hierarchy, how we get to administrative rules. Typically, there is a constitutional command directing the Legislative Assembly to do something, such as create a system of public schools. To do that, the legislature tells the schools to go forth and teach math and science and history and things like that, but the legislature can't provide the level of detail necessary to actually manage a school, so the legislature creates an executive department agency, in this case the State Board of Education, and the Department of Education by statute directs the agency, in this case the Board of Education, to establish standards for schools, and then the agency adopts a rule using the procedures that the legislature has prescribed to carry out the legislature's intent. What happens next is the agency, when it adopts a rule, files that with the Secretary of State and then also with our office. And we evaluate each rule, each biennium. We get roughly 2,000 submissions containing anywhere from one to several hundred rules, and we review all of those for you. The first question we ask is the rule within the intent and scope of the implementing legislation, which is a fancy legal way of asking whether the legislature gave the agency permission to adopt the rule. Assuming the answer to that question is yes, we look to see whether there's a constitutional problem, whether the legislature wasn't allowed to give the agency the authority to adopt that rule. And then you've also asked us to look and see if there's any particular penalty, either civil or criminal, for someone who violates the rule. The answer that we come up with in answering particularly the first question varies greatly depending upon the scope of the authority that you've given an agency. The next page in your materials on agency rulemaking authority shows two different kinds of grants that the legislature has given. The first one is to the Secretary of State, in which you've authorized the Secretary of State to adopt whatever rules the Secretary of State considers necessary. That's a sufficiently broad standard that we're unlikely ever to find a rule of the Secretary's to be outside the Secretary's authority to adopt. On the other hand, with the State Board of Education, you've gone to the trouble of telling the board what kind of definitions to include in the rules that the board adopts, and when you get down to that level of detail, it's fairly easy for us to determine whether the agency has or has not acted within its authority. If you turn the page so that you're now behind the blue divider, we have a couple of carryover issues, one of which I'll go through briefly. An agency is required by law to submit a copy of a rule to our office within 10 days of filing it with the Secretary of State. The law provides that if an agency does not timely submit the copy of the rule to our office, the rule is void. We had a circumstance in which the Department of Human Services believed that it was making a sufficiently small change in its rules that it didn't need to submit the copy to our office within the 10 days, and so took a couple of months before it dribbled in. At the request of the committee, we had a discussion with the Attorney General's office to help provide that department with additional guidance in how to avoid adopting rules that ultimately became void, and you asked me to report back to the committee confirming that I had had that conversation with the Attorney General's office, and I have. The second item in...
Yes, Senator Minnis.
Question for counsel on that point with respect to the submission of a rule within 10 days. If I'm understanding what you just said, there was some dialogue between the agency and your office with respect to how they can do it in compliance with the statute under existing law, so there's some better understanding now. But if someone challenged that particular rule, is the fact that it wasn't submitted within 10 days sufficient to overturn the rule and illegal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, yes.
Have they resubmitted the rule and complied with the statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, no.
Mr. Chairman, I suggest it might be a good idea to do that if the rules potentially.
Council.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, when an agency does not submit a rule within the 10 days, we do inform the agency of the potential risk involved and suggest that the agency confer with the Attorney General's office about a proposed course of action.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Given the dialogue, Mr. does Legislative Council keep a list of rules implemented that have not met or complied with the 10-day standard?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, no.
I think we should, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, it seems like a reasonable, to the extent that they're not following the statutory guideline, it does seem reasonable to me.
Any attorney who'd like to challenge the rule can look at the list and go for it.
Chair?
Yes, Senator Byer.
Question of counsel. Does this happen quite often, or is it a very infrequent thing? I mean, like you've got an example here in the book of one rule that was in 2001. Is this the norm or the exception when agencies don't meet the 10-day deadline?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, my memory is that roughly once a quarter an agency will miss the deadline, and that after being informed of the need for greater punctuality in the future, that agency is in fact punctual in the future.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
How many of these rules then in this once in a quarter has the agency actually gone back and refiled to make them legal, or I guess to follow up Senator Minnis' question, are these rules all up there now roughly 4 years that are invalid if someone was to challenge them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, my recollection is that we have, within the last few years, started writing individual reports when an agency submits a rule past the deadline, and then, at least in communications with us, chooses or appears to choose not to refile the rule. This was not our practice in the past, but I believe that this is a follow-up item because in the interim, or in the previous interim, we had started making a practice of bringing those issues to your attention, even though in the past we had not and had not kept track of late rules.
Okay. Yes, Chair Brown.
Follow up to Senator Byer's question, and that is out of, you say once a year we have about four agency mistakes. Out of how many? I'm just trying to put that in perspective.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, roughly 1,000.
It does seem to me that it would be appropriate that we advise them when they've made the mistake and they've not filed timely, that they need to go through a readoption process of their rule and get it timely filed, or potentially face a legal challenge at some point if they haven't crossed their T's and dotted their I's. Is that something that we can advise them of, counsel?
Mr. Chair, we do inform an agency when an agency has turned in a rule beyond the 10-day deadline.
Right.
And we do suggest that the agency confer with the Attorney General's office about a remedial course of action.
Okay. And that is their legal counsel on these matters. Senator Minnis.
Okay. But, I mean, this seems kind of silly. If the rule's invalid, they know it's invalid.
invalid, potentially, attackable, if you will, if that's the right legal term, I don't know. It just seems like they ought to just go back and refile it and get it to comply.
Right.
If they know there's a defect there, that just makes them, I think, look bad.
Well, and certainly the records of this office are public records with respect to these rules. So if a lawyer was smart enough to think about the rule and want to do their research and request this office to produce documents as to our obligatory review of the rule, they'd get access to that information and could use it appropriately. If in a case where the rule was not appropriately adopted, counsel?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnison, I am aware of at least one circumstance within the recent past in which that happened.
Anything from that end of the table? Okay. All right, let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We also, it's our practice when an agency objects to the office's determination and then the committee adopts the office's determination to follow up with the agency, asking the agency what the agency proposes to do in light of the fact that the committee determined that the agency's rule was unauthorized or in some way unconstitutional, then we bring the agency's response to you. Previously, we expressed some concern about a rule that had been adopted by the Public Employees Retirement Board. The agency responded, and Mr. Hendricks is here to provide additional detail, that the agency thought what the agency was doing was just fine. It's my understanding that since we had that discussion, Judge Lipscomb has decided the issue, and it's not really one that the committee needs to deal with at the moment, but Mr. Hendricks can provide any additional information the committee may need.
Okay. David?
Chair Williams, members of the committee. Actually, I didn't see this one on the list today, but I presume this is the mortality tables rule, which, as the committee probably all knows, has already been determined by Multnomah County Circuit Court to be an invalid rule, and you know, that decision is currently being appealed up through the courts, and at some point we'll find out the final answer on the validity of the rule.
Okay. Thank you, David. Well, I should ask if there are questions. I mean, we all sort of know what the status is on that one. Anybody want to? Senator, it looks like you're biting your tongue.
I'm not going to go there. I'm reading this thing, and I don't know that we want to get into that.
I don't know that there's any value in sort of poking at the details of the letter here at this point, given the status of the matter. Okay, next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then if you would look under what I would characterize as the orange divider, we come to what is a large block of small type in which we've listed all of the rules that we've reviewed, all of the separate submissions. It's not individual rules because there may be many rules in each submission. The agency that submitted the rule, what it was about, and then our answers to the key questions as to whether the rule appeared to be within the authority that the legislature and the Constitution had conferred. To point out that for the many hundreds of submissions that we get, we find no problem with roughly 98% of them. That's a number that's held true for the 25 years or so that this office has been reviewing administrative rules. Of the 2% of rules that we find some problem with, roughly three-quarters of those are ones in which when the agency discovers our concern, the agency agrees and then goes about fixing the rule. In roughly a quarter of the 2% of the time, the agency thinks that we're wrong and shows up here to try to explain why the agency thinks the agency is right and we're wrong. The materials behind the orange tab, which are for your approval at this time, are the summaries of the reports in which we found nothing wrong. When we conclude a review, we post this information on our website so that an agency can see that essentially the agency doesn't have a problem. Those that are on the form in bold type are those that we'll be having the individual reports on following what will hopefully be your adoption of the reports behind the orange tab. Typically, the committee simply adopts the rule review reports in bulk.
So everybody has a chance to sort of leaf through. We have four separate administrative rule reports, which we'll take essentially one at a time because they're separate reports. But as counsel described, the ones on the reports which are bolded will be the ones where the rule did not pass. The test is set out at the top of each of those reports in response to the three questions that the Legislative Council Committee is, or Legislative Council's office is statutorily authorized to do during these rule reviews. So what we will be doing essentially is adopting these reports, essentially approving the ones that have gone through the process appropriately and that have answered all the questions the appropriate way. Are there particular questions, Senator Mintz?
Well, I want to make sure that we don't have, I want to see if there are any DHR rules relevant to prior authorization in the OMAP program, any of those functional areas that are being included in this block. Anything to do with the formulary prior authorization, Senate Bill 819 from the session?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, the rules that are in front of you.
Yourself?
Oh, I'm Holly Robinson, Legislative Council's office.
Thanks.
The rules that you are reviewing were submitted from May 2nd, 2000 to November 15th, 2000, so the rules that you're requesting are not in this packet. I don't know that I've even gotten to that batch yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, typically during the interim between sessions, the committee would slog through all of these because the committee didn't meet during the interim, or if it did, was not to review rules. There's quite a backlog, and the intention is to have the committee meet roughly once a month through the session to try to get through the backlog before you start in on the rules that would have been adopted in response to the measures that you passed in the 2001 session.
It's hard to remember what we were doing during the interim that kept us so busy, but
I don't know.
It seemed like the only time we were able to get a quorum was when we were deciding whether we were going to sue somebody. So, all right, so we have the reports, and why don't we just take them in order? So the chair would move the adoption of the administrative rule review report, including rules submitted from May 2nd, 2000 through June 15th, 2000. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection? Hearing none, the report is adopted. Chair would move adoption of the administrative rule report, including rules submitted from June 15, 2000 through August 8, 2000. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection? The report is adopted. Chair would move the adoption of the administrative rule review report for rules submitted from August 8, 2000 through September 28, 2000. Is there a discussion on that motion? Is there objection? The report's adopted. And finally, the chair would move the adoption of the administrative rule review report from September 28, 2000 through November 15, 2000. Is there discussion on that motion? Is there objection? The report is adopted.
Good work.
Council.
Thank you. That brings us to the portion of the meeting involving individual reports, what we call separate staff reports, where our office found that there was a problem with an administrative rule, advised the agency, at this part of the meeting, the attorney who prepared the report, which is in your materials under the individual number. This is Administrative Rule Report 17603, in which Ms. Robinson has prepared the report, will explain the report. There is a response from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and if a representative of the department chose to attend and present information, it's usual for the committee to hear from the agency, following which usually there's a discussion of whether the agency has, in the committee's view, followed the legislature's intent, and then a motion whether to adopt the office's report. So I think at this point it would be appropriate to call on Ms. Robinson.
Okay, Holly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this isn't quite so exciting. In the summer of 2000, the Department of Veterans Affairs submitted a rule that gave broad authority to the director to assign, reassign, and move grants and donations that were given to the department to other entities within the department. I questioned the authority of the director to do that. Their letter in response to our report indicated that they thought that they just had plenty of authority to do that. And the 2001 legislature enacted a bill that gave the director of that department the authority that was described in the rule. And they will not be here today because the problem has been solved.
I guess I was following you all the way up until the part where you said the problem has been solved.
Well, they passed in the 2001. They introduced a bill, in fact, addressing the concerns and gave themselves the authority that they wanted.
You gave them the authority.
We gave them the authority after they adopted the rules.
They didn't have.
Correct. But they thought they did, but then they introduced the bill anyway.
Right. I noticed in Director Mangus's letter that he suggested that they did have the authority, but they fixed it with a statute.
They fixed it, yes. Their response was also actually predating the rule to introduce a bill that this assembly passed, giving them statutory authority.
Okay. Senator?
Well, help me understand this. We now have a statute that gives them the authority that the rule proposed to do. Does the rule still stand, or has it been withdrawn?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it has been revised to more accurately reflect their statutory authority currently.
And submitted within the 10-day period.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, obviously. But you're...
Okay, further questions? I tell you, this is really the exciting stuff right here. It doesn't get better than this. Thank you, Holly. Next.
Now you have to move to adopt.
Oh, we need to move to adopt. All right.
We need to adopt the
office's report. Madam Speaker moves that we adopt the office's report on ARR 17603. Is there a discussion on the motion? Is there objection? The report is adopted. And Corinne, if we adopt something when people are out of the room, will you note in the minutes that they're excused? So we're missing both Senator Ringo and Senator Brown and Senator Clarno, so they should be shown as excused on the record.
Unless they stomp out.
Okay. So the next one is ARR 17615. And Mr. Hendricks.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. This report, if anything, is even less exciting than the last one.
Is that possible, Dave?
Well, you'll see. One of the nice things about waiting this long before having a meeting is that these things tend to iron themselves out. This was a little issue relating to a PUC rule that raised the most common type of issue we run into, which is not necessarily lack of authority, but actually drafting a rule that conflicts with the statutory provision. In this case, it had to do with the timing on expedited hearings for certain disputes between telecommunications hearings. Arguably, the rule, when you read it, could be read to indicate that the parties could waive the statutory timelines, which was indicated a hearing had to be held within 30 days and a decision within 45. The commission indicated they agreed the rule was ambiguous, and they have since adopted a new rule to make it clear that the intent was to basically allow people to waive hearing if they wanted to, in which case the timelines are preserved and pretty much resolves the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. So, in short, the agency agreed to modify its rule based on the recommendation by this office.
They did.
Okay.
Is there questions for Mr. Hendricks about this one?
Need a motion?
Yes, Senator, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of, how do I do this?
Administrative Rule Report.
Administrative Rule Review 17615.
Senator Minnis moves the adoption of ARR 17615. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection?
The report is adopted.
Next, ARR 17643. Mr. McCarthy, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel. This rule report related to a lengthy set of rules adopted by the State Parks and Recreation Department relating to permitting ocean shores, improvements, conduits, pipelines, that kind of thing over ocean shores and some natural resources removal and filling and other sorts of construction types of activities on ocean shores. And I reviewed that rule submission and found a few little nitpicky items that I felt deserved some further attention by the department, and they felt as though most of my determinations were more picky than actual nits, and so told me so in a letter. And upon further review, I suppose to some extent they are correct. However, they have submitted a piece of legislation this session to correct a couple of the things that I pointed out.
So they chose not to amend their rule after your letter. There's current pending legislation that would address some of the issues.
Generally, that, Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Yes, Senator.
Could we identify those pieces of
legislation? Yeah. Well, yeah. I'd like to know which ones you thought that they should have been doing that they didn't. And is there anyone here from the department? Okay.
Mr. Chair, no, there is no one here from the department. I think that they think that their letter is probably sufficient, and it is quite lengthy and quite detailed, and I have reviewed it and do agree with some of their, many of their determinations. In many cases, my nitpicky items were just that.
Can you pick the ones, though, that you disagree with them on, and we'll just focus on those?
In response, in one particular response, I believe should deserve a little bit more consideration. I think on my part, they have determined in my report that the question of placing pipes, cables, and conduits under or over a state recreation area, they think that reading policy statements that are statutory policy statements, that state recreation areas are included within the term ocean shore. I'm not completely positive that that's correct. If the department believes that that's true, I believe that the reading could be tweaked that way and sort of massaged that way, but using a policy statement to some extent to support a decision and rule, in my opinion, is a little bit questionable. They have not chosen to revise that. They did choose to, I think the piece of legislation that I referred to, it relates to the definition of improvement in...
Okay. Council?
Mr. McCarthy, would it be best to characterize ARR 17643 as a result of your review of the department's response no longer having a negative determination and therefore no longer requiring separate action by the committee?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chamoff, yes.
Thank you. Just move on to the next item.
Does that mean that they win and that we don't need to take any action on this? I don't need to drag Director Carrier in here and get him to...
Mr. Chair, I believe it's a tie. They agreed with some, they disagreed with others, and I'm willing to sort of let their disagreements go.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, Senator Minnis.
We don't do this very often, but I do think it would be helpful when these issues are submitted to the committee, that we have these clear issues delineated in a document from legislative council. Because we have now the letter and a letter response, and now we have kind of obscure, you know, they agree in part, disagree in part, et cetera. And, oh, gee, by the way, maybe it's just kind of a draw. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't.
Right.
I have a particular feeling about the legislature trumping agencies because we created them.
Right.
And I really, really get ticked off when they start doing things contrary to legislative intent. I think it's an area that we, as a legislature, need to spend greater time focusing on.
And, in fact, that's exactly what this committee's responsibility is, I think, with respect to these administrative rule reviews. I guess for our satisfaction, we don't have to do it at this meeting since we're going to have a continuing meeting. It would be helpful maybe on this one if we compared our initial letter, their letter, identified the distinctions, identified whether or not they've submitted legislation that would make us having to do anything different necessary, so we've got a clear understanding of the issues raised by this report. And similarly, in the future, if we've got similar ones where we think, on further reflection, they might be right on some part and right on other parts, help us highlight those issues so the committee has the best idea as to whether or not we need to take some further action. Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brandon McCarthy, yeah, thank you. You indicated that there was some legislation pending now that would correct potentially some of these deficiencies. Could you give us a House or Senate bill number that is out there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the number currently escapes me, but it is a bill that deals with changing the definition of improvement. I don't recall the number offhand. I can find that out for you.
Thank you.
But he'll get you the information. Anything else? All right. We'll go ahead and move on then.
Thank you.
With no action, and we'll go to 17682. And Greg assured me that despite all of these being boring, that this one will have some real fireworks.
Chair Williams, members, good afternoon. I'm Chuck Taylor, Deputy Legislative Counsel. 17682 is a state fire marshal temporary rule dealing with fireworks. The temporary rule has expired and is long gone, but the problem that was present in it was also present in about half a dozen permanent rules of the state fire marshal, in that there was an incorrect statement in there that violation of the rule was a Class B misdemeanor. This statute, in fact, does not provide for that. I pointed the issue out to the state fire marshal, and they promptly went in and amended all of their existing rules that had that statement in them.
Okay. Good job, Chuck. Thanks. Before, any questions for Mr. Taylor? You guys didn't even laugh at the joke. The joke was this would have some fire.
My gosh,
you guys are a tough crowd. Friday afternoon. Gee, many Christmas.
All we have is this stuff to throw at.
Yeah. Just for that. Just for that, Representative Garrard moves ARR 17682 for adoption of the committee report. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The report's adopted. Next up is 17696.
Mr. Chair, members, this report is mine to present to you. This case involves the Department of Justice program to register telemarketers. The Legislative Assembly had directed the department to provide 60 days notice of or an opportunity for a person to request a hearing 60 days out. In its rules, the department inserted the number 21 instead of the number 60, and when we pointed that out to them, changed the rules so that it's 60 instead of 21.
Okay. Any questions on this one? All right. Senator Brown moves the adoption of ARR 17696 by the committee. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the report is adopted. 17790. Welcome, Ms. Vanderbilt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Virginia Vanderbilt, Legislative Council's Office. ARR 17790 dealt with rules of the Oregon Board of Investigators. The rule dealt with exemptions from licensing requirements, and I found that the rule narrowed what the statutory authority was. The statute exempted from licensing a person employed exclusively by one employer in connection with the affairs of that employer only, and the rule narrowed that down to an exemption for a person employed exclusively by one employer. I guess I didn't write the whole thing down. Anyway, it made it much more restrictive. It had to do with not just with the affairs of the employer, but very specific affairs of the employer. In my report, I pointed that out. They looked at it, they agreed, and they amended their rules to conform to that.
So your sense was, Virginia, that we established a certain standard by statute. They, on their own initiative, narrowed the standard which we had established.
Yes, they did.
Exceeding their authority.
Yes, they did.
And then they adopted a rule to fix it.
Yes.
Okay. Questions? All right,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'll move the adoption of ARR 17790 to move us along.
Representative Brzezinski moves the adoption of ARR 17790. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The report's adopted. Is it Ms. Vanderbilt again on this? Nope.
Nope.
Mr. McKean, 17816. Doug, who is my favorite drafter of relating clauses, it's good to see you.
Actually, somebody else gets credit for that one, but it's in my subject area, so that's why.
You didn't draft that one?
Yeah, Marianne Milligan actually.
Oh, Marianne Milligan. Well, she's got a sense of humor.
That's true.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of chuckles over that one. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug McKean, Deputy Legislative Counsel. The rule I'm here to review is a rule of the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. They submitted 60-some rules dealing with all sorts of civil rights issues. One of the rules defines injured worker for purposes of rules that implemented three statutes dealing with injured workers. One piece of the injured worker law deals with reinstating injured workers to their jobs once they're released to go back to work. And that, for purposes of that statute, injured workers is a little narrower than it is for other purposes because certain kinds of workers don't qualify for reinstatement. In the rule definition of injured worker, they had incorporated in those excluded workers, and the effect of that new definition excluded workers from other kinds of benefits that the injured worker laws provide protections for, such as protecting them against discrimination or giving them certain other kinds of reemployment rights. I pointed out the fact that they had incorporated this narrowing of the definition in their rule. They agreed. They have amended the rule.
Okay, other questions for Mr. McKean? I know this seems a bit mundane, colleagues, but this is exactly the way it's supposed to work. I mean, we review the rule, we look at the rule, we figure out that they did the rule wrong, that they exceeded their statutory authority. We tell them that they exceeded their statutory authority. They fix the rule to come within the statutory authority. I mean, that's exactly how this is supposed to work. Okay.
And if I've got the script, Mr. Chair, I would move for the adoption of ARR 17816.
Representative Brzezinski moves the adoption of ARR 17816. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The report is adopted. ARR 17827.
Members of the Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Virginia Vanderbilt again. 17827 was a rule from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training that had to do with private security providers. In my report, I found that there were problems with four of their rules. ORS 181875 provided that convictions of certain crimes disqualified a person from being licensed as a private security provider. And certain convictions disqualified a person for different periods of time. In the rule that the department adopted, they kind of mixed up the time periods, and in trying to sort of reproduce the list of crimes in the rule, they actually dropped a couple of the crimes out. In the response that we received, the department agreed to the report and amended their rule to conform it to the statute. The second problem that we found came from ORS 181873 that requires that a person obtain a license in order to work as a proprietary security manager or as a security contractor. In the rule that the department adopted to carry that out, the department really had the license sort of attaching to a business instead of to a person. And when I pointed that out to them, they agreed that that really wasn't the way it was supposed to work according to the statute and amended their rule. The third rule that I had problems with arose from their implementation of 181882, which requires the department to provide an opportunity to an applicant or a licensee for a hearing before they take certain actions, denying a license, revoking licenses, that sort of things. And basically, in adopting a rule to implement it, they adopted a time frame in which the applicant or licensee had to respond that was shorter than that required by the rule of the statute. And once again, they agreed with my report and they have amended their rule. Finally, 181875 authorizes the department to establish fees for licensing private security providers. And in implementing that, the department adopted a rule that dealt with the fees for private security instructors. In my report, I indicated that I didn't think that the department was authorized to establish those kinds of fees. In response, the agency disagreed, and they pointed me to a statute that I had managed to overlook that I think more than adequately supported their case, and so I deferred to their judgment, and I think that their rule is perfectly fine.
Okay. So the motion then is to accept the report on ARR 17827. Representative Prozanski.
So moved.
All right. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The report is adopted. And now we're at ARR 17917.
Okay, 17917 is also the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and this had to do with public safety officers. This is sort of similar to the rule I just reported on. 181662 sets out procedures and grounds for denying or revoking certification of a public safety officer, and it listed crimes, convictions of which mandated denial or revocation. And in developing and adopting a rule, the department left out some of the crimes that the statute included. In addition, the time frame that they established for the officer requesting a hearing was too narrow. I pointed out both of those things. The agency agreed with both of them and amended the rule to conform to the statute.
Yes, Representative Prozanski.
I'd move the adoption of ARR 17917.
917. Okay. All right. Representative Prozanski has moved ARR 17917. Is there any discussion? Any objection? It's adopted. AR 17919.
This rule is a rule of the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board, which is a board sort of within the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. And this board is basically charged with administering the Public Safety Memorial Fund, from which awards of benefits are granted to family members of public safety officers who have died or have suffered permanent total disability in relation to their work. I found problems with two of the rules. and they're kind of interwoven. I hope I can be semi-articulate and make you understand what I was trying to say. One thing that you need to know, of course, is this was some time ago, and, of course, I think we've had at least one legislative session. And so the statutes that I'm looking at are the statutes that were in effect at the time that I did the rule review. ORS 243956 provided that a person was eligible for an award of benefits from the fund if the person is a family member of a public safety officer who was killed in the line of duty, or if off duty while interceding in a crime, or if the public safety officer has a job-related permanent total disability. Those were the two ways that a person was eligible for an award of benefits. The way that the rule was written, it provided that a person was eligible to receive an award if the person is a family member who suffered an in-the-line-of-duty death or permanent total disability. And another one of the rules defined what was meant by an in-the-line-of-duty death or disability. And I don't know at this point if I should go into that or not. Let me do something a little briefer. The problem that I found with the rules was that they attached this concept of in-the-line-of-duty not just to the deaths, but also to the permanent total disabilities, which is something that the statute didn't do. For the permanent total disability, the only requirement was that it be job-related. I mean, and I guess, you know, in terms of what that difference is, I'm not sure, but I don't know that we need to go there today. But the problem was is that this concept of in the line of duty attached to both deaths and to permanent disabilities. And then the other problem was with this definition of in the line of duty death or disability. They defined it to mean a fatal or permanently totally disabling injury, which is the direct or proximate result of any enforcement action or emergency response, or injury resulting in death or permanent total disability directly resulting from public safety training for enforcement action or emergency response, that the public safety officer is authorized or obliged to perform by law, rule, regulation, or condition of employment or service while on or off duty. Well, if any of you understood that, you know, maybe you should just be doing my job, because I had a hard time.
Senator Menace may attract, but the rest of us are probably in trouble.
I had a hard time parsing this.
Right.
But it seems to me, ultimately, that they are saying that an in-the-line-of-duty death, I'm going to disregard that disability piece because I don't think that it needs to be there, can be suffered a fatal injury, which is the result of any enforcement action or emergency response that the public safety officer is authorized or obliged to perform by law, rule, regulation, or condition of employment or service while on or off duty. So it makes it sound like an in-the-line-of-duty death can occur when the person is off duty.
And it can.
And yet the statute says a family member is eligible if the public safety officer was killed in the line of duty or if off duty while interceding in a crime. The statute seems to envision that when you're off duty, there's a narrower class of events that will entitle you to an award of benefits. Now, and I thought that this rule kind of mushed those together, and that was sort of the essence of the report. And I have to tell you, the agency disagrees, and this is something that we have actually been discussing in subsequent rules that maybe I'll be talking to you, you know, in a year and a half about.
Well, we also have a current Memorial Fund bill in the House committee, mm-hmm. that if we needed to make adjustments to the statute to make it more clear. Senator Minnis, I'm going to defer to you to explain to us you are under obligation either by statute or by your employment relationship as a public safety employee to intervene even when you were off duty. Am I correct?
Well, it's really an interesting discussion, because sworn police officers do have the authority under the law to enforce the statutes either on or off duty. However, many agencies like my own try to restrict the on or off duty enforcement activities because they don't want officers to make bad choices in terms of how they exercise those duties for the reasons related to officer safety. You don't make a traffic stop in your private vehicle unless, of course, you have a blue light and a siren, because you have to comply with other statutes, and agencies tend not to like their officers to do that because it creates a whole series of other problems like communications, cover, you know, other safety-related issues. So I think Virginia's right. I mean, it looks to me like they've tried to craft a little bit more narrow rule dealing with the off-duty stuff to kind of conform with most of the directives of the agencies, but I think the statute may need some additional review. And an example of this, we had an officer who was killed in the line of duty. It was determined on his way home from court. He was compelled to go to court as a matter of duty. He was killed in a car accident on his way home, and that was determined to be an in-line of duty death. He really wasn't interceding in a crime, per se. But this statute contemplates that they would be actually needs work.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
It sounds like possibly what the chair is thinking about is having legislative council bring forward whatever fix may need to be put into the statute through this bill, and we can just take care of it that way.
Well, yeah, what I would like to do actually is to have the folks at DPSST who were responsible for the program, who do have bills in front of the House Judiciary Committee related to this program, perhaps communicate with Virginia about the rule issue, and, you know, even perhaps with Senator Minnis to sort of weigh in with your experience and see if we can, if there is something that needs to be fixed, see if we can get it fixed, and not, because it doesn't make sense that we would sort of leave it unaddressed for two legislative sessions and keep having to come back and mm-hmm. talking about it in a rule form, because I don't think necessarily there's a real policy disagreement. It's just making sure that we line the rule up with whatever the statutory requirement is.
And Mr. Chairman, there's a compelling need to have the statute be very clear, because there are some persons who may believe that they're entitled to a benefit from the fund, and if there's obscurity in the statute or the rule, it creates
right.
real undue hardship for families.
And not only undue hardship for the family, but the fund has to manage its risk in such a way that it's appropriately funded for its potential liabilities, and so they need real clear direction. And that's, in fact, one of the issues that's currently in front of the committee, is they're concerned that they are potentially assuming some unfunded liability that they're not sure how to deal with. We may end up doing that piece of what we need to do and send that bill over to your committee anyway, Senator, and that might be the best place to make these changes. Okay. So, Virginia, do we adopt your report? Is that what we do?
Well, I think you should.
All right. Well,
Mr. Chair?
So moved.
Okay. Senator Minnis moves the adoption of ARR 17919. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? The report is adopted. 17923. Welcome back, Chuck.
You're passing on the opportunity for a joke on these two, huh?
Mm. Oh, boy. You know, I didn't even look down hard. Help me out, Chuck.
What's funny about
the electrical and elevator board, although this one may have its ups and downs?
There you go.
It's late on a Friday, and Representative Shetterly isn't here to help me with my humor. So
it'll be uplifting.
There you go.
Co-chairs, members, again, Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council. 17923 is an electrical and elevator board rule establishing continuing education requirements for various categories of licensee. In this case, it included a continuing education requirement for some people that are exempted by statute from continuing education requirements. So they have gone in and fixed the rule and taken those people out of it.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Any questions for Chuck? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I move ARR 17923. Move it. I'm not moving it. I'm adopting it.
Representative Brzezinski moves the committee adopt ARR 17923. Any discussion? Any objection? The report is adopted. And now we'll go to ARR 17925.
And again, that is the electrical and elevator board. In this instance, it was a very thick rule packet, and there were several points that I reported on. One dealt with industrial elevators. The rule allowed property owners to do work on them, which wasn't permitted by statute. There was also a rule provision for licensing people to do mechanical work on elevators. We cut off licensing for those folks under a 1999 law. And then there was also a provision in there allowing consideration of work experience for those people that was acquired after the statutory cutoff date for work experience. The agency agreed on all of those points and has, I believe, rescinded all of those rules. They disagreed on one point that I made, and that disagreement may have some continuing value for consideration. In one of the rules, it says that in order to perform electrical work on an elevator, you have to have one particular type of license. And in the rule, they provided for other types of licensee to be able to do that work. I said that that wasn't permitted by the statute. Their reply was that there is, in the electrical safety law, kind of an implied hierarchy. That you go from one type of licensing to another, and as you go along, one category of license will have all of the qualifications of the next lower class plus some additional qualifications. So the practice has been that where the statute says you have to have a certain type of electrician license, they treat that as meaning you have to have that type of electrician license or a type of license that has higher qualifications. I think that they're correct that that is the implied scheme in the statute, and it's probably the way it works every day. It would might be worth considering whether there needs to be some kind of express provision in the statutes that actually says that's okay. Because we do have a lot of statutes that identify a specific type of license, and there's nothing that says that type of license or a higher one. So I will toss that part, that thought out, and you may want to consider, as far as OAR 918-400-335 subsection 5, whether that part of the report should be withdrawn or discounted or whatever.
Council?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Taylor, let me see if I can summarize your suggestion for the committee. It's that the committee adopt your report, but also consider perhaps for the 05 session submitting legislation that would clarify the department's authority to do what it's doing. The department's rule appears to reflect what happens in the real world, and that maybe the statute needs a little updating to reflect that.
Mr. Chamov, I think that's a fair assessment of what I'm saying, yes.
Representative Brzezinski.
Madam Chair, I would move for the adoption of the ARR 17925. And I don't know if you want to do that bifurcated or do you want the other part?
Separate it out, please.
And also that the committee consider submitting new legislation to take care of the problem that has been set forth under this report for the 05 session.
Representative Przanski has moved that we adopt the report number ARR 17925 and consider submitting legislation that would clarify the department's authority to do what it is currently doing. Is any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to do now number four on the agenda, special rule review under ORS 183720 sub 7. And that's Virginia again. Yes, counsel.
By way of introduction to the committee, there is a provision in our current rule review statutes that allows any person who believes that a rule is duplicative of another one or is in conflict with another one to ask us to prepare a report, submit that report to you, and then if you choose, you may adopt the report agreeing that the rules are in conflict or duplicate each other. That's the extent of the statutory directive in this case. In my tenure, this is only the second time we've had a similar request.
Okay, Virginia.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm still Virginia Vanderbilt, and as Mr. Chamoff has indicated, this is only the second time on his watch this has been done, and as far as I know, it may be the second time ever. It's certainly my first time, so I'm not exactly sure how much detail you want me to get into on this. The rules at issue are rules of the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision and rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, which might indicate, at least to some of you, that it has to do with sentencing issues. I have, in my report to the committee, I have outlined the rules and outlined the requester's propositions as far as why he believes that these rules are in conflict. I don't know if you want me to go through that or if you want me just to leap to my conclusions. And I would look to you for guidance.
Leap to conclusion, I would suggest.
Big C. Yeah, Senator Minnis moves we leap to conclusions.
Excellent. I'm good at that. Mr. Chair, after looking at these rules, the person who requested them is a man who was convicted of aggravated murder. He committed his offense in 1990 and was sentenced in 91. One of the conflicts that he thought was there is that the rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, which, as you know, are kind of sentencing guidelines rules, say a lot of stuff about the purposes of criminal penalties, what they're supposed to do. And he maintained that those sort of general purpose statements conflicted with specific rules of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision that had to do with establishing sentences and murder review hearing dates for people convicted of aggravated murder. The rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission contain a rule that says that a person convicted of aggravated murder isn't sentenced with reference to sentencing guidelines because the sentence is set by statute. We have it set out in the statute, and we don't look at sentencing guidelines. In addition, in 1989, when we enacted sentencing guidelines, we enacted a law that provided that certain of the parole provisions continued to apply to persons convicted of aggravated murder. Because of that, I don't think that these rules do conflict. The sentencing guidelines rules really don't have application to the particular rules of the parole board that he's talking about, because the rules of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision deal with aggravated murder. The Criminal Justice Commission rules don't. However, I will make one exception to that. There is a rule of the Commission, OAR 213-005-0004, which basically says that a defendant convicted of aggravated murder has to serve a sentence of lifetime post-prison supervision. Because a person convicted of aggravated murder isn't placed on post-prison supervision, if that person, in fact, is released at some time after serving his 30-plus years, the person is released on parole. So I think that with that one rule, I think that there is sort of a conceptual conflict there.
Senator Miss.
Mr. Chairman, Virginia, it's not too difficult with a defect of repair or with a simple amendment to deal with it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I mean, the problem is really with the rule. So, I mean, I would think that what needs to happen is maybe the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission should be asked to rethink whether or not that part of that rule needs to be.
Have we gotten a response from them in with response to sort of your advice, Virginia?
Mr. Chair, the agency received a copy of this. The agencies received a copy of this.
Right.
It isn't a rule report, you know, like the ones that we just went through. They aren't obliged to respond. It's more just notifying them that this person has requested a rule and a review, and I assume has invited them to be here if they want to be here. So I haven't heard anything from either of the agencies that are involved.
Okay. Thoughts? Senator Minnis?
You know, you could craft a statute that says no agency can draft a rule inconsistent with blah, 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 and deal with it statutorily if the agency doesn't want to. But what do you do? Send them a letter and say, here, fix this? I think the council committee could send them a letter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's sort of traditionally what we've done even on the rule reviews, and sometimes we didn't have that situation in this review, but we have had agencies come back in this room and say, we disagree, and our lawyers at DOJ say you're wrong, and at that point our limited ability is to say, fine, you know, we'll get you in a statute, and that's really the extent of what our ability to do is. Representative Posansky.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask for a procedural. It looks like maybe we want to adopt Virginia's report and then make the motion that a letter be sent to the Criminal Justice Commission to respond to the potential or apparent conflict in the rule, so we can get that in motion.
Okay, let's have discussion on Representative Przanski's suggestion. Anybody?
It's as good a starting place as any.
Yeah, I think so too. It's to adopt Virginia's report and then move to direct a letter to the Criminal Justice Commission to respond to the issues raised in Virginia's report, which we could put on the agenda for the next meeting.
Senator Beyer wanted to amend the motion to
Get rid of
sunset.
Criminal Justice Commission.
I tend to think, Senator, that it's outside the scope of the motion and would be ruled out of order given the nature of this committee's authority. But I understand the sentiment. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's appropriate that we CC Mr. Engweiler in the letter to the commission.
Okay. I would agree. So we have a motion. Why don't we just make first the motion from Representative Przanski to adopt the report prepared by Virginia Vanderbilt to the committee, which is before us at this time. trying to define it better, but it's the report with the subject rule review under ORS 183.720 sub 7. Is there any discussion on the adoption of the report? Any objection? The report is adopted. Representative Przanski moves that Legislative Council's office directs a letter to the Criminal Justice Commission asking them to respond to the issues raised in Ms. Vanderbilt's report, and that such letter also be copied to Mr. Engweiler from the Department of Parole and Prison Supervision. Is there any discussion? Any objection? That motion carries. Our last order of business before we're preparing for adjournment, or maybe our second to last order of business after that, we'll go before adjournment. So what we're going to do is we're going to move now to the presentation of service recognition awards, and I'll ask counsel to direct us through this. This is actually the fun part of the afternoon. Council?
Mr. Chair, members, before I guess what I'm going to do is introduce the new continuing staff, then we'll present the employee recognition awards. Also behind your last green divider is a letter from the Department of Administrative Services awarding the office a gold star for doing all of its accounting work right so that you can be assured that we don't have any Enron-related problems. That's a compliment to Ms. Cook, our Administrative Services Manager, who's going to be helping handing out the various awards today. First, the new continuing staff, Nancy Ankenbrandt, is one of our publication specialists. She is unable to be here today, but publication specialists in our office are the folks who specialize in the arcane drafting system with which we produce your bills, and without them and without the work of the editors, what you would get would be the gobbledygook that leaves the attorney's offices. And we are ever so grateful for the work that they put in on that. The continuing folks that we have are Steve Ludall and Laura Sands. Would you stand,
please? You have to
please?
Stand. Yes, yeah, thank you.
Steve and Laura are editors in our publication services section. They are in their second session with us. Like Nancy, they are part of a continuing process in the office that the committee and Ways and Means has so far supported, which has been taking what in the past was a large number of session positions, rolling them together into a smaller number of permanent positions, so that when we find particularly talented session people like Steve and Laura, we can offer them employment on a continuing basis, thereby providing you with better service. Thank you very much for joining us. We also have Kunyan Kwan. Kunyan is a former member of Senator Brown's staff. Visitor Services comes from the renowned restaurant family in town and works at our front desk with Midge, putting the best touches on our good cop, bad cop routine. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Assume she's the good cop. Sorry, Midge.
No, I said something. No, you're going to be in trouble. I said something about Midge in the last meeting, and she hasn't let me forget it. So just be careful.
I'll bring her chocolate.
And finally, we have, it's not a new person, but a new position, Cindy Hunt, who has been a deputy legislative counsel as a result of having survived 10 years in our office and having provided exemplary service, has been promoted to senior deputy counsel, which provides not only a nifty new word attached to her title, some additional administrative responsibilities, and a small additional addition to her otherwise meager salary. So thank you very much.
And with Senior Cindy, does that get you the discounted Old Country Buffet? Okay.
Okay, now we have the, have I forgotten anyone?
Okay, then we have the Service Recognition Awards. These are awards that go to folks who have served us in five-year increments. You have materials, some nice written comments from the head of our Publication Services section about the folks who are in her part of the office. I went around trying to get some more personal and memorable detail with which to introduce people. One thing you will note if you look at the materials is that people will be getting awards for years that are less than if you subtracted this year from the year they started working for us. That's because many people here started as session employees and then continued on a continuing basis. The first person to receive a award is Kathleen DeVito. Kathleen has been with us now for 5 years. She assists Chad Colburn in our indexing unit. Those are the folks who prepare the bill index that you get every week, who index the Oregon laws and put together the index on the Oregon revised statutes. Before coming to us, Kathleen was an employee of the Salem-Keizer School District for 20 years and is the only person I know with a grand piano in her living room. And so for her 5 years of service to the office, what do we have for Kathleen?
We have a beautiful card holder.
Yeah.
Thank you. Stand up, Kathleen.
Next, we have Andrew Kirchen. Andrew is an editor in our Publication Services section. I should say a note about the editors and the folks in Publication Services. Undoubtedly, this is the first time that many of you will have seen Andrew or anyone else from that section. That's largely their preference. You may run into the lawyers, but these folks are all professionals. Their job is to make sure that what the lawyers are doing is intelligible to regular people, and in any bill, go ahead and keep standing up there. In any bill that you get back from us, any draft, the lion's share of the work has been done by the folks in Publication Services, the product would not be anything like it is without their efforts. They get very few opportunities to get the thanks that the attorneys get because they're not in the front lines, but every time you get something back, I hope you will think about these folks. Andrew began his professional career as a reporter, went from that to screening voice messages for a dating service, and eventually left his beloved North Carolina to join us and has now been with us for 5 years and gets his own spiffy card holder, for which I presume we don't have cards. But thank you very much. Clark Siegfried is also getting his five-year award. Clark is from Brooklyn, our thankfully one and only Yankees fan. Clark is noted in the office for his many fine collections, or many fine items in his collection of old baseball memorabilia that includes a program from a game in 1886. So thank you very much for being with us. Next on the list is...
He gets his card, though.
Oh, card. I'm sorry. Yes, there's no truth to the rumor that Denny Jones was included in that program. Vicki Kreider is one of our senior editors and has managed to escape. She was going to be here until 2 o'clock, and we will make sure that we provide her with another opportunity to get your approval.
Chuck Taylor is receiving his 10-year award. Chuck started with us as a law clerk and then was hired to work on the annotations that are part of the Oregon Revised Statute, and still does the annotations but has stayed on taking on ever more significant responsibilities in drafting. He came to us after a career in which his principal responsibility was to climb up a smokestack, collect the gunk out of it, and analyze it. And I understand that he considers his employment working for you folks to be even better than that. Thank you.
Next year.
With ink.
With ink. Excellent. Thank you. And thank you, Chuck. No, no cards. Lori Grady. Ms. Grady is the supervising publication specialist in publication services. She's the one who knows how to make our computer program drafting stuff work better than anybody else, is the one who works with the Department of Administrative Services in putting together all of the appropriation bills and make sure that everybody else knows what they're doing. I tried really hard to find something particularly memorable to say about Lori, and the best I could find out was that being the avid athlete that she is, at one point from playing volleyball, she had managed to blacken both of her eyes, which caused my predecessor, Mr. Clifford, to express great concern about her family life, which she assures us is just wonderful, and as I understand, she is still playing volleyball. So thank you very much. And for 15 years. Then, Ms. Vanderbilt.
Yes.
Yes, you have to stand. In preparation for her career with Legislative Council, in her youth, she was a dog sled racer, and worked for the Postal Service unloading or loading trucks in 60 degrees below zero weather in Fairbanks, and decided that after that experience, what could be better than to work for the Office of the Legislative Council, and so has been here for the past 15 years, principally working in the area of criminal law. You were also kind enough a few years ago to allow her to spend some months in what was then the new former Soviet Republic of Kyrgyzstan, helping them set up their office of Legislative Council. And if you ever have the opportunity to listen to Virginia regale you with her stories of that adventure, I highly recommend it. Well, Virginia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Then, finally, we have Joan Robinson, our Chief Deputy Legislative Counsel. For those of you who don't know, that means that Joan has all the authority that I do, and because she's actually been here for quite a while, she actually knows what she's doing. I asked Joan what it was that I should say about her, and she said to tell people that she is a calm, peaceful person who spreads serenity throughout the office. And then to see how many people laugh. Joan began her career with the Legislative Assembly in 1977, working with the House Committee on Aging. She then spent two sessions and two interims with the Judiciary Committee, and then after that joined our office and has been with us since, rising up through the ranks until she's pretty much in charge of everything. Joan, in her position as chief deputy, is also the chief editor of the Oregon Revised Statutes, so that when you're done adopting all of your laws, it will be Joan's pleasure or burden to take all of those and blend them into the state's current laws. Thank you very much. And for 20 years, she gets
a lovely
Pendleton blanket, moth grant.
I just want to take just a minute, and any other members certainly can do the same, but just to express, especially those of you who are being recognized here today, our real appreciation for your hard work. As Greg pointed out, some of you we see fairly regularly as we're coming to you to help us with our bills or in consternation about our bills. Many of you we don't see. You really operate to a great degree in the bowels of this process, but were it not for what you do, we would not be able to accomplish the things that we do accomplish in a very condensed period of time where we know it is an extreme amount of work and a whole lot of pressure, and for a job that you do not get thanked by us nearly enough. So truly, in all sincerity, on behalf of me and members of the committee, and I'll certainly open it up to anyone else who wants to add their words, but we really do appreciate all that you do, and we know that we don't say it enough. We know the public doesn't say it at all, because they truly don't understand what job it is that you accomplish in this building, and we want you to know that we really do care. Anybody with any additional words or comments?
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Clarification on the gift rule that they have. I caught that early, and I wasn't sure exactly what that was.
Yeah, they can give them to themselves. They just won't take them from lobbyists.
Oh, from lobbyists.
Yeah, right.
Because actually,
or members.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do agree with the comments you made with respect to legislative counsel. I found myself from time to time in conflict with them because they have to sort through my brainy or not-so-brainy ideas from time to time. They help sort them out and make sense of them. But I would hope that you and I could perhaps get together and do something with them, or they might be invited to lunch or dinner. And I don't know that that would or violate the rules.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's been tradition, at least that we started last session, that at some point we spring for some pizza and at least a luncheon that we can all go down and join them down in the committee. And I've left that to the discretion of Mr. Chamoff as to when he thinks, from a timing perspective, that would be the most appropriate. But it would be my intent.
Probably should do it before things start ramping up.
Well, we still all like each other.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Thank you.
So thanks again very much. Thank we appreciate you. It. Representative Minnis, Ms. Madam Speaker.
I'd like to serve a notice of possible reconsideration of the vote related to citizen initiative. I think it needs a little further review. Kind of came in at the last minute, and since it's a law that we have not put in, I think we need a little more time to examine that.
Okay. Representative Minnis has served notice of possible reconsideration as on item number 2 of the agenda, and the vote by which the committee considered the request for cooperation in drafting citizen initiatives. She's joined in that notice of reconsideration by Representative yeah, whatever your name is. Gerard. Sorry, Bill. It's been a long day. And you've been so quiet. It's the only thing you've done all meeting. And I couldn't get your name right off the top of my head. Representative Gerard, what we will do, colleagues, is we'll discuss this issue and, because of the timeliness of this issue, attempt to have the Speaker choose to proceed on this issue. She served notice of possible reconsiderations. Should she choose to proceed, we'll find a time, attempt to find a time early next week, perhaps in a morning, an early morning before things kick off, to reconvene the committee to address a potential vote on reconsideration. Co-Chair Brown.
At which time the Senate will be chairing.
At which time the Senate would be chairing. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, all of you. We will now stand adjourned.